It's Thanksgiving week, and we all have much to be thankful for. But does gratitude always translate into generosity? Leo Sabo joins us today to discuss three things your pastor wishes you knew about giving. Then we have lots of great listener questions ahead, but we won't be taking your live calls today because this program is pre-recorded. This is Faith and Finance on American Family Radio. Biblical wisdom for your financial decisions. Well, it's always a treat to have Leo Sabo on the broadcast. Leo's a FaithFi contributor and the president of the Christian Stewardship Network. Leo, great to have you back with us.
Always a pleasure, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Leo, CSN recently posted a really intriguing article, Three Things Your Pastor Wishes You Knew About Giving. Now, before we get into those things, why is it important to know our church leadership and have these conversations with them?
Well, that's because effective giving conversations are crucial for the health of the church, but also its members.
Yeah.
You know, usually when we're talking about this, we're focusing on financial goals, but conversations can and should go beyond just the numbers. After all, because God owns everything and we are stewards, money decisions are not just practical. They're also spiritual, revealing our motives and our hearts.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. All right, let's dive into these areas. What's the first thing you believe our pastors want us to know about giving, Leo?
Yeah, the first is members need to hear more about the spiritual benefits of giving. Your church leaders are probably well aware of the connection between giving and discipleship. They also want you to know that learning to trust God with your money is a major component of your spiritual journey. Once you grasp that, it changes the way you feel about giving. Pastors would like their people to know that there's a holistic approach to stewardship, comprising not just money, but time, talent, and treasure. Generosity is about conditioning of the heart and its willingness to help in all respects, not just with the dollar amount. So still discussing spiritual benefits of giving, some people think that tithing is the only part of believers' money that God cares about, but your pastor wants you to know that a love-inspired steward sees everything he or she has as God's and gives him total authority over 100% of it. And your pastor also wants you to understand that giving is between you and God, not between you and the church. Giving to the church is not a membership fee. Our giving is to God through the church, but it's really giving to the church, but really we're giving to God, not to the church for its needs.
Yeah, that's so foundational what you just shared there, that our giving is an overflow of our gratitude to God, our recognition that He owns everything, and even an act of worship. All right, let's continue to move through this list, Leo. What's the second thing you believe pastors want us to know?
Yeah, it's really important to understand stewardship, and pastors want members to understand its meaning. Stewardship is the responsible management of resources, including financial resources. And many churches offer courses on responsible financial management. Pastors want their people to know that the financial programs and classes that they offer is for their benefit. The Bible provides wisdom for managing money through financial principles like saving and budgeting and debt and investing. And also, Jesus talked a lot about money and possessions because he knew that how we interact with these has a lot to do with the condition of a person's heart. Stewardship is an important part of discipleship, and pastors want you to know that their motivation is to offer these to you from the right heart. And also, faithful stewardship always leads to generosity. And that reinforces, of course, the first thing that your pastor wants you to know, and that is the gain of spiritual benefits for giving.
Yeah, there's no doubt that stewardship is a key component of discipleship. All right, one final thing. What does your pastor want you to know about giving?
It also concerns transparency and accountability regarding the gifts. The goal should always be that church leaders and those striving to achieve it want their members to know that it's a priority to them. It's important because it's becoming common for people to express concern about financial transparency and call for greater accountability in churches and nonprofits. They want to know that their donations are being used responsibly. And this gives the church both a responsibility and an opportunity to show that members themselves and the community are recipients of ministry resources, like good teaching, support, an environment to gather, worship, and serve, and a staff to manage all of that, all of which are funded strictly by donor generosity.
Well, Leah, I know you talk to a lot of pastors, and so this comes from a place of understanding, and I know it's been an encouragement to our listeners today. If folks want to get connected with CSN to perhaps get help in starting a stewardship ministry in their church, Leo, where should they go?
They should go to ChristianStewardshipNetwork.com. We'd love to help.
Excellent. Leo and the team have been working with churches for a long time, and they can give you all the best practices for launching and running a healthy stewardship ministry in your church. Again, ChristianStewardshipNetwork.com. Leo, thanks for stopping by.
My pleasure, Rob. Thanks.
As I said, we're off today, so don't call in, but we've got some great calls lined up in advance, so we'll go to those just around the corner. I'm Rob West, and we'll be right back. Well, thanks for joining us today on Faith and Finance on American Family Radio. I'm Rob West. All right, it's time to turn the corner. Take your questions today on anything financial. What are you thinking about? Living, giving, owing, or growing will help you think about the practical decisions you need to make in your financial life as a steward in light of biblical wisdom, because we're managers of God's resources. So when the steward is seeking to be faithful in managing the master's resources, you have to understand the heart of the master. So we go back to the scriptures and look at the big ideas and themes that we're to give generously and hold God's money loosely, and money becomes a tool to accomplish God's purposes. We should live with contentment. These are all of the ideas that we see in scripture. In Luke 12, the parable of the rich fool, we need to be on our guard against covetousness and greed and trying to allow money and possessions to fill a role they were never intended or are able to occupy successfully. They can't give us purpose and meaning. They can't fill our deep longings. That only comes from God himself. So when we make God our true treasure, then money becomes a tool to accomplish God's purposes. We want to remind you of that each day on this broadcast. But before we head into those phones today, in the news today, a change in how you can use leftover money in a 529 education savings plan is generating a lot of interest. Now, starting this year, you can roll 529 money into a beneficiary's Roth IRA. This change was a part of the Secure 2.0 Act, which was passed in 2022. Analysts predicted the change would have a big impact, but perhaps not this much. According to a new report by Saving for College, this is a company that promotes 529 saving. And by the way, they have my favorite tool to evaluate which state's 529 savings plan you should consider. It may not be your home state. They report 3/4 of parents surveyed say they're more likely to save with a 529 plan than before. 23% of parents say they've already opened a 529 account because of the change. Now, since the beginning of the year, about $100 million in 529 assets has been rolled into Roth accounts, which again shows the level of demand for this option. Now, there are some specific restrictions on these rollovers, so pay attention to these if you're considering this. And by the way, again, this is for money that's in a 529 plan, which, remember, is growing tax-free so long as it's used for qualified educational expenses. But the challenge always comes up, what if my child doesn't go to college? Or what if they don't use all of the money? Well, there are some ways to get it out. Most notably, you can get it out pro rata on a scholarship or grant award. But what if they just don't use it all and you don't want to transfer it to another child, another beneficiary? Well, having the ability to roll the money into a Roth IRA for the child, for the beneficiary, to use much further down the road in retirement, but to seed that account right now is a huge option. It's very attractive on the part of parents and grandparents who are opening these accounts, knowing that, well, at least I'll have the ability to move that money into a Roth. What a blessing that will be. Now, with that as a backdrop, here's the restrictions. First, the money must have been in a 529 account that's been open for 15 years. So the account has to have been established at least 15 years ago. If not, you just got to wait till you cross that threshold. Now, separate from the account, any money that you're converting or transferring to the Roth IRA, that money has to have been deposited at least 5 years ago. So the account has to be 15 years old at least. The money that you're transferring has to be in there for at least 5 years. Now, rollovers are subject to the usual annual Roth contribution limits. So, for instance, for 2024, under the age of 50, you could put in $7,000. And there's a maximum lifetime amount that can be transferred into a Roth per beneficiary and that's 35,000. So again, 7,000 this year and whatever next year's is, and you continue right down the line year after year, but you would eventually hit that maximum lifetime amount of $35,000. Now, if you haven't opened a 529 savings plan yet for your kids' college, you now have one more reason to get it done. Again, my favorite tool for saving for college, because think about this like a Roth in that it's tax-free growth, but the big idea here is that, you know, you take the money out as long as it's used for qualified educational expenses, you pay no tax on all of those gains. So hopefully that's something helpful for you, is just consider one more option to get that 529 going. Let's go to Michigan. James, you'll be our first caller, sir. Go ahead.
Yes, blessings to you today. We got a new pastor about a year ago, and he's done a fantastic job at our small church. We've gone from almost doubling to almost tripling in size, which has been phenomenal. I'd like to help him out financially. I was wanting to know if there's a way I can give him a direct gift, not through the church, that would not be considered where he'd have to consider it as income.
Yeah. Absolutely. So you can make a gift without even letting the IRS know of up to $18,000 to any individual for the year 2024. And, you know, there's no tax paid by anyone. I think the key would be, you know, that, you know, there are no tax consequences here, no tax implications. And, you know, I think the main point there is that there's not any kind of services rendered or anything like that. So if this is literally just a personal gift from an individual, not for services rendered, then there's no problem there. And you know, you'd be able to do up to $18,000. If you go beyond $18,000, it would just require that you file IRS gift form 709, and then that would chip away at your lifetime exclusion.
Right. Can I ask a second question on top of that?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
If like the church, like, you know, I know a lot of churches down that we've done it in the past where you give a, you know, like a gift during Pastor Appreciation Month and people pool their finances, the treasurer cuts a check to the pastor through the church members. Now, is that taxable or is that not taxable as well?
It would be, because the pastor is employed by the church, so it's coming directly from the church. And, you know, there's no way to classify that as just a kind of a love offering without it being taxable.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much. Yep.
All right, James, we appreciate your call today. There's a great resource that you may want to check out if you haven't already. You'll find it at blessyourpastor.org, and it comes out of the National Association of Evangelicals. But they have some wonderful ideas on how you can bless your pastor, including a great resource that you can download with just 50 practical ideas. Again, you'll find that at blessyourpastor.org. And they've been doing this for years now. And again, a lot of great resources there that you may want to check out. Hey, let me mention, if you've been blessed by the program, maybe you listen regularly or you found something on the program to apply in your financial life and you'd like to consider becoming a FaithFi partner, we'd certainly be grateful. It's a blessing to us as we see more and more people jumping on board as a partner. A gift of $35 or more would qualify you for pre-release copies of all of our studies and devotions, and you'll get our new quarterly publication, Faithful Steward. It launches in January, a 52-page beautiful digest with some really insightful articles to take you into God's Word, to encourage you and equip you as a faithful steward. Again, to become a partner, just go to faithfi.com and click Give. Now, just a quick reminder as we head into this next break, don't call in. Our team is not here today. But we have some great questions we've lined up in advance. Those will be coming just on the other side of this break. We'll be right back. Great to have you with us today on Faith and Finance here on American Family Radio. By the way, if you've not checked out our website recently, we'd love for you to do that. The wealth of content, articles, podcasts and videos there to help you be a wise and faithful steward of God's money is incredible. You'll find it all at faithfi.com. You can visit that on your smartphone or on your desktop. Again, faithfi.com. Just click the content button. Also, while you're there, check out the FaithFi app that can help you manage God's money and access all of this great content on the go. Just click the app tabs. Again, it's all at faithfi.com. To Youngstown, Ohio. Hi, Ellen. How can I help?
Hi. I have some I-bonds that I got on treasury.gov a few years ago, so I didn't know if if interest rates might be going up again or down or keep them or sell. Or
yeah. It's a good question, Ellen, and I think, you know, although we had those pretty attractive I-bond rates a couple of years ago when they got up to 9% there for a short period of time, with inflation coming down consistently, and I think it will continue to stay low, the I-bonds are less attractive now. It's probably a better option for you to go ahead and pull that money out and think about doing something else with it. What is the time horizon on this money?
Nothing that I really need right away.
Okay. Yeah, so you would have an opportunity to do something a bit more long-term. You know, if you wanted to keep it completely safe, you could put it into, you know, perhaps a three-year CD and do better over the next 3 years than you would do in that I-bond, even after you pay the three-month penalty if you're pulling it out, you know, before the requirement there. But if not, you know, I think the opportunity there is beyond the CD to consider investing it. If you're willing to take a little bit of risk, you would certainly, you know, do better over the long haul with a properly diversified stock and bond portfolio. But leaving it in the I-bond, considering rates are coming down and the primary driver of the I-bond rate is the CPI, Consumer Price Index. And with the Fed working overtime to make sure that stays low, despite government spending and other factors that, you know, are inflationary, I just don't think you're going to do as well over time. And so probably best to lock in the return that you got and then reposition that money elsewhere.
Great. Thank you.
All right. We appreciate your call today. Let's go to Chicago. Hi, Renee. How can I help?
Hi. I just have a question about starting to save for retirement. I'm kind of late to the game, 48, just a new career change. So I don't know, like, what's the safest way for me to start saving. I don't know if I need to do something, like, safe and long-term and do, like, I really don't know where to start.
Okay, sure. And, you know, how long are you planning, just based on what you know today, to continue working? Probably for the next 20 years, maybe?
Well into my 60s.
Yeah. Okay. So you still got, I mean, even though you're starting late, you still got some time on your side. And I think the key is right now just to minimize your lifestyle and look for ways to save on an automatic basis in a tax-deferred environment. Do you have a retirement plan available to you at work?
I do, but I haven't initiated yet.
Okay. Yeah. Do they provide any matching of any kind?
No, they don't.
Okay, no problem. And do you have some margin such that you could start contributing on a monthly basis? And if so, have you determined how much?
Yes, I'm thinking like maybe $200 a month.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I think the key is just to do some planning, and there's some great online calculators that would allow you, if you just put in your search engine, you know, investment appreciation calculator or something like that, you could run some scenarios that would say, okay, you know, if I were to put away $200 a month for the next 20 years and that were to grow at 7% a year, you know, it would tell you how much you'd have in the end. So if you're starting with zero and you did 200 monthly at 7% for 20 years, you know, that would only give you about $8,500. But, you know, I think that's annually. Hold on, let me do monthly here. So, yeah, that would be about $100,000. And if you took that and you said, okay, $100,000, you know, at 4% a year,
that would give you an extra $4,200 a year that you could add to Social Security, let's say. You know, $4,200 a year, about $350 a month. So I think the key is, what would you be able to do beyond that? And maybe you're able to increase it over time. I think as a good guideline, it might be to say, you know, ideally, I'd like to get 10 to 15% of my income going into retirement. And because you're starting a little bit later, you want to try to get to that 15%, you know, as quickly as possible. For instance, if you were to be able to put $500 away, you know, that would give you about $260,000 in 20 years. And, you know, now all of a sudden, you know, we're able to pull out, you know, at 4%, you know, that's $10,000 a year. So now we're talking $800 a month that you could add to Social Security. So I think by running some of these scenarios, you could get a feel for, okay, you know, what do I need to put away to ultimately reach my goal, recognizing that Social Security was never intended to cover more than 35 to 40% of your pre-retirement income. And most people live on 70 to 80% of their pre-retirement income in that season of life. Now, there are other ways to offset that. Maybe you work a little bit longer. Maybe you work part-time when you get to that place. I think the key here, though, Renee, is just to say, listen, I realize I'm starting a little late. That's okay. But what do I need to do to minimize my lifestyle spending? Because that's probably your biggest barrier to you being able to save what you need to save over these next 20 years, which, again, is still a long time. But, you know, you probably need to be putting away quite a bit more than $2,400 a year. Now, you can always start where you can start, but what can you do to be able to increase that over time? But that 401k is going to be a great place for you to put that money because it's a tax-deferred environment. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Okay, good. So here's the next step. Go ahead and call HR. Tell them you want to get that 401k started. Start where you can with whatever that monthly systematic contribution is. Maybe it's $200 a month, but let's not stop there. Let's go back to that budget and say, what can I cut out? What can I trim so that over time I can start moving that monthly contribution up so I've got more working for me? You can do this. We'll be right back. Great to have you with us today on Faith and Finance on American Family Radio. Our team is away today, so don't call in, but we lined up some great questions in advance, and we'll be going to those here in just a moment. Let me also remind you that the advice that I give each day on this program is general in nature. We offer principles and ideas that apply at a high level. They are not personalized, so that's why you should always seek professional financial advice. And if you'd like to find a professional who shares your values, you can find one at faithfi.com. Let's see, we're going to head to, well, we'll stay in Chicago. Herman, go ahead, sir.
Okay, back in the end of January of this year, I went to bankrate.com and put my money in one of those offline banks, online banks, whatever you call it. I was supposed to get 5% a year. I initiated $80,000 in the bank, put $80,000 in. February, I took out $20,000 and bought a car. But now it's back up to $100,000 in the bank. And I've only received $1,000 interest. Now, 5%, I mean, it should be more than that, even though I took money out, right?
Yes, I would think so. Because even, I mean, what do you think your average balance has been over these first 10 months or 9 months plus some days?
$80,000.
All right. So if your average balance was 80,000, you know, at 5%, that's 4,000 over
right.
The year. Now we're not quite that far. So if we, we say we're 3/4 of the way through, that'd be about 3,000. Now, do you know how they pay it out? I mean, most of these, the most common payout would be a monthly payout. So normally the way these high yield savings accounts work is you take the APY, the annual percentage yield, and you can divide that by 365 to come up with your daily interest rate. And then you apply that to the balance on any given day. That tells you how much you earn for the day. And then the next day, they take the balance plus the interest you accrued on day one, And that's why it's compounding, because you're getting interest on the interest. And so you right. take that APY divided by 365, and then you can calculate the amount of interest you earn each day through the daily compounding. And then they normally have a monthly payout, which just means at the end of each month, the bank totals up the daily interest amounts, and they deposit the total into your account as interest for the month. And so that would be the way I would expect that to happen. But yeah, I mean, if your average balance for three quarters of a year is, you know, running $80,000, you should have certainly much more than $1,000. Now, some of these will do a quarterly or even an annually annual payout. That's not my favorite option. You know, there would be those would typically be smaller institutions or credit unions that would do that. So what I would do is I would reach out to them and just ask for them to break down, you know, where the deposits and the withdrawals were, what your average balance has been, what the payment schedule is for the interest, and, you know, to help you understand exactly what's been paid out and why it's lower than you think. And I would expect there's an explanation for it, but we need to figure out what that one is.
Yeah, I sure will. That was my next move, to call them. For sure. Okay, yeah. Mr. West, well, thank you very much.
All right, Herman, we appreciate your call today. I'm sure you'll get to the bottom of this, but thanks for being on the program. Let's see, St. Louis is where we're headed next. Jacob, go ahead, sir.
Hi, Rob. I want to thank you for your ministry and everybody at Faith Finance. A quick That's question. Awesome. So I have about $5,000 in debt, including an auto loan and some medical debt. I'm trying to buy a house within the next 6 months. I want to be able to have my credit as high as it can be at that time. So I was thinking about pulling out a personal loan to pay off all that debt to get it off my credit report. I'm just wondering if that would be a good idea or not.
Yeah. Well, I certainly understand what you're trying to do. You know, how does, so let's take the, so you said you have auto loan debt and medical debt, no credit cards. Is that right?
So I have just got a credit card, but I'm keeping it at the 30% credit utilization right now. I'm boosting it as it goes, but I just wanted to get the negative remarks off my credit report.
Yeah, what are the negative marks that you have? Did you have some late payments?
So I had a car that had got crashed a while back, and now it is out of work. And yeah, I wasn't able to pay it off, and it was charged off as bad debt.
I see.
And then I have some medical debt also that was charged off for a hospital ride.
Got it. All right. Well, the auto loan debt that was charged off is probably not going to come off. I mean, that'll fall off over time. I think it's 7 years. The medical debt will have to be removed once it's paid off. So that one might be worth considering, although, you know, I'd want to talk more about this personal loan that you would be taking out. Is that from a family member or friend or something?
No, it was off of Credit Karma. They were offering for 60 months. I just know that having a certain diversity of credit, too, also can bump your credit. I'm new to all of this credit stuff, so.
Okay. Got it. Yeah. So I think the key here is, you know, I'd rather you not be out getting new credit until that time comes. Now, a medical charge off will be removed after you pay it off. And so that is going to, you know, help you. So if you pay it off before the 7 year period, it will have to come off. That will not be the case with the car. So that would be the one to think about. But keep in mind, you getting another type of loan, you know, is not necessarily going to improve your credit on it its own. But if it's, you know, done in order to get the medical debt off, then it certainly could. But apart from that, you know, the best thing you can do is just show yourself as an on-time payer every month moving forward and keep your balances low. In fact, if we're talking about credit card debt moving forward, it's not even in my mind a matter of just keeping it low, although that's important for the score. It's really about you only using that for budgeted items and paying it off in full, because the extent to which you're using it for spending that you can't pay off in a single month would tell me you really don't want to have a credit card. It's just too dangerous. But purely for looking at the credit score, I think the key is try to open, you know, as few loans as you can, because that process of the inquiry and taking out more credit is not necessarily going to work in your favor. Number two, there's not a whole lot we can do about the car debt other than just let that become further and further, you know, in the past, because the most recent information impacts you the most. And then the extent to which you can demonstrate yourself to be an on-time payer every month is key. If you could get that medical debt removed by paying it off in full, that would be great. But I'd really rather you do that by just dialing back your lifestyle and trying to prioritize any surplus to that rather than you taking out a new loan of any kind. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I appreciate you.
Absolutely. But what I would say is, once you get that medical debt paid off, then I would really go to that credit bureau and, you know, dispute that information on there. They'll verify that it's zero. It should fall off on its own, but if it doesn't within 30 days, certainly 60, I'd contact them, because that should be eliminated and that will help your score out. Hey, Jacob, we appreciate you listening regularly, and all the best to you. Let us know if we can help you further in the along the way. We'll be right back. Hey, great to have you with us today on Faith and Finance on American Family Radio. I'm Rob West. Here in our final segment, let's head back to the phones to Missouri. Merle, thanks for calling. How can I help?
Hi, Brother Rob. I just wanted to ask a simple question about how my credit score will be affected if I take all of my credit cards to a Christian ministry management program. How will my credit score be affected if I turn those all into them?
Yeah, it's a good question, Merle. The fact that you're in debt management, which is what Christian Credit Counselors offers, another name for it is credit counseling. The fact that you're in that program is not a part of the credit scoring algorithm. However, when you go into those programs, the cards are closed. And by virtue of you closing that account, just like anyone who closes a credit account, does tend to have a slightly negative impact on your credit score, because either, number one, the credit history is removed from the history that's being considered to create your score, or number two, it can change your credit utilization. Those are the factors that tend to result in there being a modest or, you know, very minor dip in the credit score. But the fact that you're in the credit or the debt management program is not in and of itself going to hurt you. I guess I would ask, though, what is the primary driver of you thinking about your credit score? Is it really just to keep it up in the off chance you need it? Or is there something specific where you're seeking credit and you're concerned about that score affecting you?
There is nothing specific. I was just concerned about lowering my possibly already poor credit score even more, and I do not want that to occur.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So you need to be prepared that you could see a slight dip as a result of going into the program. You know, my personal opinion is that's less important, especially if you don't have any, you know, borrowing on the horizon. That's less important than you getting out from under this debt once and for all, not paying the high interest rates that you're probably paying now, and recognizing that once this debt is paid off and you're now down to zero, which is going to improve your credit utilization and show you to be an on-time payer, that's probably the best thing you can do for your credit. But again, that's longer term, and the short-term impact of these accounts being closed could cause that score to dip. So you just need to know that, even though I would say that it's worth it, in my view. Does that make sense?
Absolutely so. Bless you, Brother Rob, mm-hmm. and thank you so much for your assistance.
All right, Merle. God bless you, buddy. Thanks for calling. Let's see. Lazara, how can I help you?
I love your show. First time caller. My question is, I'm expecting a proceed of health insurance. The proceeds, do I have to go ahead and declare it when I prepare my taxes at the end of the year? Those or not?
Yeah. So what is it you're getting? You said, is it life insurance?
It's mature. The policy mature. So if I haven't used the service, they will send me the money.
Okay. So it's called, is it basically what's called a return of premium?
Correct. There you go. I think that's what it, you hit the.
Okay. It likely won't be taxable unless there's a gain. So basically, they're just paying you back the return of the premium that you've already paid in because you didn't use it. And you paid more because you had that rider on it, likely, which allows you to get the premium back if you don't use it. And that's considered a refund, not income, and is generally, and you'd probably always want to double check with your tax preparer, but generally that's not treated as income because it's considered a refund.
Great. Thank you for clarifying that for me. Yes. Thank you so much. And I wish you the best. Have a great, blessed day, sir. Thank
All
you.
Right.
And I appreciate what you do.
Absolutely, Lazara. Thanks for calling today. Let's see. Let's go to Ohio. Jeffrey, you're next up on the program. Go ahead, sir.
Hello, Rob. My mother recently had a stroke and is no longer driving. And she's given me the power to get rid of her car. And one of my siblings would like to purchase it. However, my question is, how much of market value do it I have to get it to her for before there might be some red flags as to, hey, something's going wrong here? I don't know. Maybe there is no red flags. Or if she had to go on Medicaid before she died, if she would say, they go back for 5 years or something and said, hey, this is wrong or something.
Yeah. So now, is it your mom that's making the gift to your family member, to your sister, or somebody else?
She would be doing it. Yes, she would be doing it.
Okay. And so this is not factored into kind of her overall estate plan. She's just deciding for this particular child to make an outright gift to her in the form of selling the car at a discount. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. Well, there's an $18,000 annual exclusion here. So she could sell it to her for a dollar if she wanted. And you could check with Edmunds or KBB.com to determine the fair value, the fair market value. And if it's less than $18,000, then she could just do it and nothing happens because it's considered a gift, essentially, for anything that she buys it for below what's considered fair market value. If it's above $18,000, the portion that's considered the gift, she can still do it. She would just have to fill out gift tax form 709 and let the IRS know, and that would eat away at her lifetime gift exemption of more than $3 million. So in either case, it's not taxable. It's just based on how much the overall gift is and whether that needs to be reported.
Okay. Well, I think we should be safe there because it's valued between 15 and 17, so we should be good there.
Yeah, so it sounds like that's not an issue. Now, the only other issue would just be the Medicaid look back. Is she collecting from Medicaid by chance just because of her assets and situation?
She isn't now, but she probably will because her assets are depleting quickly at this point.
Yeah. So there's a look back period of 5 years to determine whether or not she gifted assets that would, get her to that threshold where Medicaid kicks in. And if they see that assets that were in her name that have been gifted, you know, to a family member has happened within 5 years of Medicaid starting to pay her bills, they may not pay just because they would want to factor in the cost of the car that she gave away.
Okay, so then how close to fair market value should we, my sister would like to purchase it, but because I'm responsible for the price of it, I'd like to get it to her at a deal because it's my sibling. However, I don't want to raise any red flags with Medicaid, so it still should, like 75% of some market value, or would that be close enough for purchase price, and then the, you know, the last quarter percent, or 25% would probably be just the gift then. Would that?
I would want you to check with your CPA. I mean, essentially, the IRS doesn't provide an exact percentage for how close the sale price of an asset like a car has to be to fair market value to avoid it being considered a gift. So the IRS, the general guidance is that significant deviations from fair market value could trigger a gift classification. So they're going to want to see the reasonableness of the fair market value range. And while there's no strict rule, I would just say, generally speaking, and I'm not a CPA, so that would always be a good idea, anything under, I would say, 80% of fair market value would probably be considered a partial gift. But, you know, at the end of the day, you're probably going to want to check with a tax professional just to be sure.
Okay. That's very helpful.
All right. Good. We appreciate your call today. Thanks for being on the program. Let's see, folks, we're just about out of time. Quickly to Pennsylvania. Ken, I have just a moment left. How can I help?
All right. Real quick, I get a state pension. I started at 51 years old at $3,000 a month. I'm going to turn 62 here in a year. And if I put in for my Social Security at 62, how will my pension affect my Social Security income? Because it's $3,000 a month and goes 36, and it's my understanding maybe a dollar for dollar might be taken away over a certain amount.
Yeah. A pension can affect it, through what's called a windfall elimination provision. So did you pay into Social Security throughout the time you were funding the pension?
No, I did not.
Okay. Yeah, so there's something called a windfall elimination.
While I was funding the pension, yes, I did. Not since I've drawn the pension. I haven't paid into Social Security, but all I have an account built up. I'm due $1,800 a month at 62 here.
Okay, got it. Yeah. So if you're talking about the, are you taking Social Security, you're taking it before full retirement age, right?
Yes, at 62, okay. I was planning on doing it if I'm not going to lose some of it to do it.
Yeah, so pension income is not counted toward the maximum income for Social Security before full retirement age. Only earned income, like wages or self-employment income, is considered when determining whether you're exceeding the Social Security earnings limit. Is that what you're referring to?
That's fantastic. You've eased my mind because I want to start drawing at 62. So I appreciate you and I appreciate the wisdom the Lord has given you and the way you're using it.
Well, thank you. That means
thank
a lot
you for Ken. Your help.
All right. Lord bless you, buddy. That's going to do it for us. Let me say a big thanks to my team today. Certainly couldn't do this without them. Handling our phones today was Adam Suddeth, producing and engineering today, Mr. Devin Patrick, and providing me with great research today and just helping navigate the program is Jim Henry, my partner in crime here on Faith and Finance. Thanks to you for being along with us today, and we'll look forward to having you back tomorrow. God bless you. Bye-bye.